This is an interview with Dr. Pauline Powers for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project by Hugh G. Earnhardt at 422 North Main Street, Hubbard, Ohio, on March 3, 1975 at 1 p.m. We can do about the noises we get around in the outside and the cats and so forth, so don't worry about it.
Oh, no, don't worry, Danny.
Yeah. Would you, Dr. Powers, describe for us your early childhood, where you lived, who your parents were, and your education, please?
My father was John Powers, and my mother was Rose Weitz Powers. She belonged to a German family. Her father and mother came from Germany during the Franco-Prussian War and went into the cattle business. And she had four brothers who followed that line for the most part of their lives. My father was paymaster for the Andrews and Hitchcock Company and took inflammatory rheumatism and died at 36. Very young. They didn't know what to do, you know, that's the thing. I remember they didn't even give him water. And I was 7 years old, and he called me his little old woman, and I remember I came into the room one Saturday morning to see him, and he said, "Oh, get me a big pitcher of water, and oh, we'll have such a good time," and I trotted out after it, and a couple of doctors intercepted me, and I suppose if I'd gotten it for him, they would have said that killed him the next night he had a cerebral hemorrhage. But on Saturday, they thought he was going to be very well and back to work. They didn't know. That was 1900, you know, and they didn't know too much about it, I suppose. My mother was left with four of us under 10.
How did she support you?
What?
How did she support the family?
Well, she had a $5,000 life insurance in the house. And it was quite remarkable because G.M. McKelvey kept the company store down here for the Andrews and Hitchcock workers. And my father was at the head of that store and a paymaster for the iron company, see. And when my father died, they were very fond of him. And they came to my mother and invested that $5,000. And she raised the four of us for quite a few years on $400 a year interest. She was really remarkable. She was a wonderful woman. She cooked and baked and stayed right here with us and did everything for us, and we never lacked anything. But of course, in those days, 33 1/3 dollars a month bought more too.
That's right.
You could get 6 pounds of sugar for a quarter and so on.
We call it white gold today.
What is it?
We call it white gold today.
Yes, $2 or $3.
Yeah.
So then I went to, I started school at 6 and went to St. Patrick's until high school. Well, then I went to Hubbard High School to go through the regular high school work. But Hubbard High School at that time was only a grade 2 school, so we all of us had to go to Rand to finish. And I graduated from Rand in 1912. And at that time, you know, you didn't have to have your college before they put you in a school. So I went to, I took teacher training that summer, and I had a walk 3 miles both ways to the Hubbard Youngstown Road School. And I had 12 children in 8th grade.
This was the one-room schoolhouse?
This was a one-room school. Mm-hmm. So then the next year, I went to Youngstown. And I taught the elementary grades until, I was at Princeton School and Cleveland School and Lincoln, all at four parts of town, and Madison, and all this time I was going to college. I think I must have been going for about 30 years. In fact, I went a full year after my doctoral. It was a thing I liked to do. I don't take any credit for it. So then I got my master's from Western Reserve in 35, and my master's in Pittsburgh in 36, and the doctorate at Pitt in 42. And so that's the way that went. Then I went on and had another year at Pitt after that. I must have gone to school for about 30 years, just had got to be a habit. So one day in the summer of 32, well, in the first place, they had taken the corner room at Princeton for a sight-saving class because it had better lighting, two walls, you know. And they put me in the next room. Well, I got well acquainted with the lady. At that time, the blind and sight-saving classes had their supervisors from Cleveland for all northeastern Ohio. And
did they come to the school only certain days?
They would come, they'd spend a whole day with me every 2 months. This Miss Ollie Peck would come after me every once in a while and say, "I want you to go into the sight-saving work." And I'd say, "Oh, I wouldn't think of it. I don't want to. What I really wanted was to teach algebra and Latin in high school." And, oh, she'd say, "You're silly." So one day she hunted for me on the campus at Western Reserve, and she said, "I want you to take the Braille class in September." I said, "Oh, you can't be serious. I don't want it, and please don't ask me." I said, "In the first place, I'm afraid of the blind children. I'm afraid I'll hurt their feelings. After I got into it, I tried to take the word see out of my vocabulary till I nearly broke up." She came one day and she said, "Are you just trying to kill yourself or just go to a mental institution?" So she said, just to please me, go in and see Mr. Rodebush, the superintendent, next Saturday. And I went in and I said, "Please, Mr. Rodebush, don't move me. I don't want to change. I don't want this at all." And he laughed a little bit and said, "Don't worry," he said. "Go on," he said. "Learn some of this stuff up at Cleveland Board of Education," and he said, "We'll talk about it some other time. Don't worry." So I heard nothing, and I thought, of course, I'd go back to my regular class. The Saturday before Labor Day in the morning, I was baking a cake, and my mother went to the telephone, and she said, "A lady wants to talk to you." And she said, "It's urgent." So I went to the telephone, and the girl said, "Mr. Rodebush wants to talk to you." And he said, "Miss Powers, report to Cheney Braille at 8 o'clock next Tuesday morning," and laughed and hung up. I never accepted it. Never in the world. And stayed with him 31 years.
Before we go to that new experience, what was a typical day like at Rayon when you were a student?
Oh, you mean periods and study halls, just that.
How did you get there?
Oh, I went on two buses. I did all those years I taught, too.
Mm-hmm. From Hubbard, do you travel to the
Hubbard, from Hubbard to Youngstown downtown, and then the bus to the north side.
What time did you usually get to school?
Oh, we'd get a bus here about 7:30, and we'd get up there in after 8. Mm-hmm. I taught there then 9 years later on.
But what was the typical day like at Rand? You remember some of the teachers you had, some of the students?
Oh, yes. I had Mrs. Peterson, Sarah Peterson. Have you heard of her? Mm-hmm. She was very wonderful. And I had... For Latin, I had Isn't that funny? I can't think of Mr. Andrews. I don't remember his name. I think I had the fourth year Latin, fourth year English, and well, two other very liberal arts courses. I can't remember which I took. I know I took Latin and English. Oh, German. Mm-hmm. Latin, English, German, I suppose a math, likely.
Did you know a fellow there by the name of Patrick Kennedy?
Who?
Patrick Kennedy, who was a student?
No, I was sort of isolated with my blind children when I taught there. Mm-hmm. Oh, was this when I...
When you were a student there?
No, I don't recall. Mm-hmm. It was a Mr. Hugh Foster who taught there. I can't think who the Latin teacher was, a man. Mrs. Sarah Jane Peterson, they were all fine old timers, you know, dedicated.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that that all the students got along quite well, being the only school there outside of South?
The only high school? South
wasn't? Yeah, the South wasn't built yet, that's correct.
Oh.
That was the only high school.
Everybody was very happy. I didn't see anything. There were about one or two blacks. There was a black girl in my class that was very nice, and a black boy, and he was a hero, a football hero, so they mm-hmm. showed him every sort of respect. I believe those were only two I remember. Mm-hmm. No, everybody, it was very peaceable. Everybody obeyed, you know, in those days. Mm-hmm. There wasn't, you didn't hear anybody opposed anything in class. What the teacher said was law. If you wanted a good grade, you didn't.
Did you find that the training that you got at the Rayon School prepared you for your work in college?
Oh, it was very like college. Mm-hmm. It was really like a year in college, and very like it. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little less free because you were younger and followed the teacher's examples a little better, I guess.
But there
never was any word of opposition there.
Did you notice, what changes did you notice from the days that you were a student till the time you went back to teach at Rayon?
Well, there was a lot more freedom. I know that I can't think what his name was, said to me one day, my children, I would tell them, take them the first day to their classes, second floor or third floor, and I never had to take them again. They always went together. I remember this teacher told me a few years ago, he said if they did that now, they'd be run down. But they were nice to them. They had a real comfortable, happy time, and I wanted them to be just people, and they had a chance to be.
What was, you lived here in this house all your life.
Right.
What was Hubbard like in the 1920s?
Well, it was a village. Everybody knew everybody else. You didn't have to lock your doors because the neighbors came in, and when they did, they brought good words or food or anything that they wanted to share. No, there was no coolness at all, you know. Everybody friendly. A few new people came, everybody got to know them very quickly and made them feel at home.
Was the 4th of July a big day in the 1920s?
Oh, yes, there was a parade and all the flags were out. I lived kind of a quiet life. I went to school almost all the time. I didn't go around very much. I was a little bit, I guess, on the shy side.
Well, let's talk about your real life's work, that of teaching the blind. And you commented that you got into it by
accident.
Accident. How did you really get yourself mentally prepared to do that?
I was scared to death. I never put in a weekend like I did that Labor Day weekend. I knew I was going to be definitely afraid of the children. I remember I had two very bright girls in the class, and when the mother brought them in the morning, I said, "Mrs. May, I'm scared to death." And she said, "Don't worry, the girls will help you." And they were all very good. And the ones that had high IQs, they were marvelous. I had one boy is the first blind man to teach in the New York City schools. And another one is a computer programmer at Patterson Air Base. They both came to see me this summer with their wives. I thought of them as little boys about this big, you know.
Yeah.
And I had four, mind you, from the Becerra family, the B&B Construction Company. And that Frank was a marvel. I remember one time they had what do you call it when they visit the schools to check up on things, you know.
Evaluation?
Yeah. And I remember the day the Latin, well, they all visited me, you see, not only just one group, but I had a little bit of everything. And I can remember Frank was studying his Virgil lesson. And they went over to his seat, or they asked him to do it out loud. And do you know, he translated that Virgil, ran one hand over that page as fast as he could, made real poetry of it, and took notes with the other hand. Well, of course, that didn't hurt me any either, you know. They just stood there with ohs and ahs. Mm-hmm. I had some funny things happen, though, too, that way. I had a little midget, and he couldn't control his arms to read the Braille. You know, they didn't stay put long enough. And I had a lot of company. It was sort of, all the women's club, you know, sort of a place to do slumming, I guess. And they were all around the room, and they came to this little buddy, and he wanted to read too, you know. And I was afraid because I knew he couldn't hold on to the line. He read them, the little red hand, he said, with all the embroidery. You never heard the story told that way. And oh, they thought it was wonderful. And I thought, well, will I tell on the little guy or break his heart?
Yeah.
So I thought the women wouldn't care, and I kept quiet. I think he was making most of it up, you know.
Yeah.
Now I have another funny memory. I had two twins, six-year-old twins. And they were the naughtiest children I ever saw. You couldn't understand their baby talk, but they swore continually the most awful oaths. Oh, they got, I'll tell you after you take the tape off some of the things I thought. And it was awful. Every time I went to the office, I had to take a twin on each side because it wasn't safe to leave them. I might throw something at one of the older ones, you know. And one day, I think I read one little fairy story to Jimmy, I believe 100 times. The father liked Sammy and didn't like Jimmy. I don't know why, but the neighbors told me that one day little Jimmy was sitting at the floor beside the father, and the father put his hand out like that, and the child turned toward him and he said, "You made a mistake, Daddy, I'm Jimmy." It must have been awful. And talking to their home over the telephone was like talking over the battlefield of Gettysburg. It was terrible. The father was putting the boots on a little three-year-old and broke his leg doing it. So they must. Well, I felt so sorry for them, and oh, I just hoped and prayed that I could get through to them. Well, one day at noon, the other children were listening to the radio, and they both came over, and one got up on each knee. And oh, they were so good. And I said to myself, you know, now I'm getting through. Now I'll teach them something. And you know, in half an hour, they were covered with measles.
Oh.
You know, the devil.
Yeah.
A saint would be.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was funny. Well, then I had them all ages, kindergarten right through high school.
You taught all grades there? In
all grades. They went out to every class, to every one of their classes every day.
Mm-hmm.
That they were determined would be, because otherwise they might as well be in an institution. We wanted them to have all the contact with sighted children that was possible.
Right.
But they did all their homework with me, put in all their study periods, all their free periods.
Mm-hmm.
Even the kindergartens would go to the kindergarten 5 or 10 minutes a day. And then when we went to Cheney, I was 22 years at Cheney, and we had everything under one roof then. But at Rand, they took the junior highs to Hayes from 8 to 12, and then they came back and did their work with me.
Mm-hmm.
And the seniors stayed right there and went out to their classes. And the little ones, we took over to Harding twice a day for an hour each.
Who was behind this program?
Cleveland School of Northeastern Ohio, because I had every blind child except the ones that were in Columbus, in the institution, from Northeastern Ohio. They'd come and board them during the week at some place and send them every day.
Well, was it the Youngstown School Board, or was it the Blind Foundation?
I think it was the state.
I would like to interrupt here. Well, I was a foster mother for two of her blind.
Yes,
boys.
She was a foster mother for a couple of Mrs. Burns.
And it was through the Catholic Service League.
Through the Catholic Service League.
Yes, and I had two boys, 12 and 14 years old, for three and a half years, I think. During that time, Dr. Powers had to retire. They had a compulsory retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
And she came down to my home two or three nights a week and tutored those boys because she wanted to after she retired, to make sure that they got what she wanted them to have in order to graduate. And I thought that was pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid they'd quit high school if they went back to their homes.
Yeah,
one came from Steubenville and one from where?
Wyndham. Yeah. Donnie came from Wyndham.
Mm-hmm. I loved them though. It was fun. I enjoyed it. I had all kinds. I had two idiots that drew, you know.
Why would they select Youngstown for this type of program rather than, say, Cleveland or...
There were three centers: Youngstown, Cleveland, Cincinnati.
In other words, this was sort of a regional...
Yes, ours was Northeastern Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Who paid you the...
Catholic Service League got in touch with me.
No, but who paid you for their keep during that time?
Catholic Service League.
The state?
I think it was, but it came through the Catholic Service League.
I think it was a separate thing, all separate part of the Youngstown Board of Education.
Mm-hmm. How many students were in this program at any given time?
Oh.
How many would you have in your room?
I had 12 seats, 12 big desks to hold those big books. And I was supposed to have never more than 12, but I'd have two in each seat.
Mm-hmm.
So I had 24.
Mm-hmm.
20 years I did that by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Every grade, there was never a dull moment. From 6:30 in the morning, I was out there putting books into Braille for them. It was impossible to get every textbook that Youngstown used, you know, in Braille.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then...
you actually did this yourself?
Yes, the ones that weren't available.
Mm-hmm.
And then when, a few years later, Mrs. Julius Kahn came out to visit me, and she said, "Well, this is terrible for you to have to do all this extra work." She said, "You're working 10, 11 hours a day." And she got her group, the Braille for the Adult Blind, and changed them over to helping me Braille some of these books. They were, the Jewish women were wonderful to me.
There wasn't anything at that time like what the Library of Congress does.
Yes.
Was it available too?
They had
in some areas.
What do you call the books?
The
talking books.
Yes.
And then we got the books, you know, too, for the books that were available. But they couldn't see to it that Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus, and Youngstown all use the same textbook in Latin or in English or so on. So that was what made the extra work. Mm-hmm. And then the parents look at it so differently. Some of them just adored them, you know, and pampered them, and some would like to lose them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'd be there at 5:30 waiting for a parent to pick a child up, and he'd say he forgot. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Essex said to me one time, "Well, what do you do it for?" And I said, "Well, will you tell me what to do?" I said, "The cleaning women don't have to look after my children." And I said, "Suppose it was a broken home and one of the members kidnapped a child and I was to blame for it? Or what if he walked out on the street and got killed?" I said, "There'd be an inch high headline in the paper. Where was that teacher?" I said, I don't see any other way. So that's the way it was.
You've used the term which you obviously use very affectionately, my children.
Oh, they were just, say, I had them 12 years. Mm-hmm. I had lots of them from first grade or kindergarten right up through the 12th grade. I felt as though they belonged to me.
It was sort of like that one-room schoolhouse.
Yes,
situation.
Yes, they were closer even than sighted children, I think.
How did these children get along in other sections of the school?
With other children?
Yeah.
Fine. The other children made such a fuss over them. Mm-hmm. That was the way. Unless they were, now the four Lebanese children, they are very clannish, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to take part in the things that the rest did. I never could break through that. I don't know mm-hmm. what it was, whether they still were like that or not. Mm-hmm. But they were all brilliant, those four.
You obviously had you enjoyed teaching.
Oh, I loved it.
What were the...
I'd like to get a good job right now. I told Dr. Pugh that's all I needed, a good steady job. Yeah. But I don't think they take me.
What were some of the problems that you faced in teaching the blind?
Well, you had to make certain, you had to act a little differently toward them. Sometimes they were very withdrawn, sometimes very bold, you know, according to their, like my brother-in-law says, it all starts down here with mother and dad. That's who he blames it on. But they come to you, you know, and I never tried to spoil them. Oh, I said, I will tell you this. One time Miss Peck said to me, I said, "Why are you so persistent about my teaching these children when I don't want to?" She says, "Well, I'll tell you," she says, "I think you're warm enough and outgoing to have a shoulder for them to cry on." And she says, "You're not sloppy and sticky. I know you're not going to kiss and love them and spoil the life out of them." And that's the last thing they need. Mm-hmm. So you had to be careful about that. Not to, and of course, never show partiality. They could sense that, mm-hmm. even if they couldn't see. I don't know. You just grew with them. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the secret.
Did you feel that their lack of sight, they made up in other sensitivity areas?
Oh, yes. Touch, hearing, they were as keen as could be. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm offering that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
How was the funding for this program? Were you always able to get the materials and the things you needed?
Yes, and I don't think they ever refused anything within reason that I asked, never. Mm-hmm. I think it came through Cleveland, but I'm not certain. Mm-hmm. At least everything went to these Cleveland supervisors. That's no longer true. The reason that I tutored those two little boys was that when I left and they had three or four children still in high school, they put men teachers in that had no braille at all. And the child, well, just had to depend on his hearing, and maybe they read to them, I don't know. But they certainly were handicapped, and that's why I worried about them. They're smart too. The boys pretty nearly all married nurses. Now I didn't teach them that or how to make money, but they knew how to marry somebody to take care of them.
Maybe they learned that from you by osmosis.
I don't know. I wasn't a nurse.
Well, now these kids that came here from out of the city that you taught, now, did they stay then in private homes and things of this sort during the week?
That's right, like with Mrs. Burns.
Mm-hmm.
And they were brought in taxis, or not usually taxis, more often cars that were hired by the Board of Education to bring them.
Mm-hmm. In other words, they didn't ride the school buses or anything of that sort?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of them. I had Pete Wabak. He has an orchestra now and a nightclub. And the driver of the Poland bus said to me one day, he said, "Honestly, Miss Powers, I think that kid knew which brick to get off." He said, "I never needed to tell him to get off. No dogs, no canes. None of mine had them." The fella in New York City that teaches there has a blind wife who is a social service worker. They go all over that big city without a cane or a dog. Mm-hmm. I get lost when I get outside of Grand Central Station.
Yeah. What other work did you do with the blind other than teaching?
Well, I tried to get them into all the outside things that I could where they would fit. I wanted them. My whole ambition was that they would be just people, like everybody else, no different, and to be treated that way and to act like that. And that was what I worked for all the time. So when things had come up, I tried to get them a part of it, and I took them myself if I could, or got somebody to take them. So they'd know everything that was going on as much as possible.
What was the salary of a teacher at that time?
The first year out at Hubbard, I got $40 a month, and I walked 6 miles every day. And then the next year in Youngstown, 45, and then 50, and 55. Then when I taught the blind, I think in addition to whatever your salary would be, there was a subsidy of $150 a year. That was all. There weren't any $7,000 and $8,000 salaries in those days for it.
There aren't any today either.
No.
Well, as you look back on teaching the blind, your work as a teacher, do you see anything that you would have done differently, or you would have changed in connection to this special type of education that you did?
Well, I might have tried to get them into certain classes that were forbidden to them at the time. There were very few. But now at Rand, one teacher refused to have any pupil of mine in a biology class.
What reason did she give?
She said that they did most of the work with the
dissecting.
But the one of the men there was extremely nice about it, and he said, "That's nonsense," he said. "They can get a very great deal with their ears, and they can come into my class," so they didn't lose out. And then I suppose some people thought it was a bother too, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to keep that very low.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them sent them back pretty quickly when I'd send them over to visit, and I would be a little bit hurt about it, but I had to take what I could. I remember the first year I taught them, one of my little boys in the fifth grade came down and he said, "Miss Powers, the two fifth grade teachers up there said that they had a big enough room to take care of big classes, and since you were hired to take care of us, they didn't know why they had to have us." And I said, "Well, don't worry now, just keep quiet. We'll try to find out what's wrong." So the two came down at noon, and I said to them, now I had nothing to do with scheduling these children. They were scheduled last spring before I came. But I will talk to Mr. Rixhaker and I'll ask him if he would like to take them out of your class. And they said, "Oh no, it's all right, let them come." They didn't like that.
Yeah.
Not one bit.
How did these students, can you remember as a group, looking over all those years you taught, how did these blind children overall in their grade, in their schoolwork? Were they average students?
Of course, it was still a matter of IQ.
That's right.
The ones with 150 IQ really were tops, you know, like this Frank Bechera. You go into his office now, he's in the B&B Construction Company, and he's talking to New York on one phone, Chicago on another, like a big tycoon, you know. But if they were low mentally, they didn't. I don't think that the matter of the Braille had too much to do with it. I think it was entirely mentality. Because I had two idiot children. I had to take them. They said they had to have a chance, and that if they were blind, psychologists say they belong more in a blind class than in a retarded. But blind children don't belong there. Of course, you can see that they use sight for most of their training, so it's very possible. But finally, they took them away. They came from outside cities. After a year or so, after we'd give them a chance. One of them never talked about himself in the first person. David does this, David does that. One day a group of women were in the room, and he wasn't feeling well, and I had him on the couch. And one of the teachers in the hall, that same corridor, came in, and as she went out, she said, "Pauline, will you quit your worrying?" Well, in the afternoon, I had a big class, a big bunch of women there. Out of a clear sky, David says, "Pauline, will you quit your worry?" Well, they looked as if they thought I'd lost my mind.
Yeah. Did these women who served as volunteers, I guess, is that the word?
Well, that one, the Jewish group, did. They were the only ones at that time. The others just visited, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, would these be parents or guardians of these children, or just people who come in from...
No, clubs, women's clubs. Different ones that just were curious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One lady came in one day, and one little girl was reading something, and these women had the idea that if they couldn't see, they couldn't hear either, you know. And this lady leaned over and whispered to me, and she said, the little girl was reading the Braille to her, and she leaned over to me and she said, doesn't she see even light? No, doesn't she see anything? And the little girl says, not even light. Went on reading. She heard it.
Yeah.
But they weren't insulted or hurt, I don't think. I taught them all to knit. You know, one nice thing about it, that one of my girls, a lot of the girls worked in x-ray departments afterwards, you know. I wrote to Kodak and different companies, and they arranged to finish the x-ray with a bell rather than with the formerly they had lights, see, mm-hmm. so the blind could do that, help in that finishing.
Mm-hmm.
And a good many of my girls did that kind of work then afterwards. Mm-hmm. And some of them were very musical. One of my girls was music supervisor in Youngstown for many years, just retired last year.
Mm-hmm.
They are quite musical because they have good ears. I had, people were awful nice to me. I had lots of honors. Was National Teacher of the Year in 1915. 2,000 Women of Achievement and Community Leaders of America. And Who's Who of American Women, National Social Director. You know, that each one gets something about the other and
mm-hmm.
gets you on their list. It isn't much fun when your mother's gone. You know, nobody else cares.
Mm-hmm.
This thing came last Saturday. I don't know whether it's something from bygone days or not.
Oh, the Bicentennial Award.
Oh, I guess that's why it is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's nice to be remembered.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell them you have to be sick to know how many good friends you have.
Well, it's just that sometimes when you're sick, that they take time to
think about it.
To pause and remember.
That's right.
Or you know, when you're up kicking and they're up kicking, well, you know,
sure,
well, still
yeah,
spinning.
Everybody has its own problems.
Mm-hmm.
It was very worthwhile, all of it. I hated terribly to lose it. But they're so nice. They come to see me in the summertime when they're back in Youngstown, bring their wives and children along.
What else did you do besides knitting for special projects as far as teaching?
Well, they couldn't do much drawing, of
no,
course.
Sorry.
It was mostly some kind of handwork. Some of them took sewing in the sewing classes. Then during those years, I taught night school at South, English for foreigners, for 22 years. And I had, oh, that was wonderful. I had all of Hitler's and Mussolini's refugees, and some of them brilliant men, you know, doctors and so on, but they lacked the idiomatic English to pass our tests, you know, and they couldn't practice. And all of the stories they told me, they would have bad flu, they said, during the flu epidemic, down under the street, and the Gestapo up above walking, catching them. One man, I had the nicest compliment I ever had from Mr. Ben Friedman. He and Mrs. Doris Bergman, his sister, were my students. And one day, I met him afterwards, you know, he's head of Danada Aluminum. As he sold it for $3 million and bought it back when it failed in Niles for $1 million. So he wasn't too stupid. But anyhow, I met him at an anniversary of one of the Jewish ladies, and he came over to me and he said, "Miss Powers, to me, you are America." He said, "When I think of how I was abused in Russia and downtrodden and not able to look at anything," and he said, "somehow you gave me back some human dignity." And I didn't do anything in the other cases either. I just tried to treat them like people, that's all. In fact, I never did anything except my Mr. Caulfield took me to the Lions Club party a year ago. They come and get me for the Lions Club Christmas party where the blind children come and and they bring me home. Mr. Caulfield and Mr. Who was the ROTC man? Fisher.
Fisher.
Those two came a year ago for me. So I got to know them. The Lions are wonderful to me. They just have been my right arm all those years, you know. They come down every day or so asking that, and then they did a lot of the entertaining of the blind children because of that, you know. They got so well acquainted. I don't think they bother to visit so much anymore.
How did you land the job of teaching foreign citizens the English language?
Before what?
The foreign citizens, you know, the people who you were teaching the English language to at South.
At South?
Yeah.
Well,
how did you land that job? They call you up on the phone and give that to you too?
No, I don't know how I got it, to be honest. I think they opened a class I don't know. I don't know whether I applied or not.
Did you teach this every night?
Two nights a week.
How long were the sessions?
Oh, about 3 hours.
How many students would be in there?
Oh, a whole room full. Now, one night the principal came in, he says, "Honestly, Miss Farris, I never saw so many kinds of arithmetic in one room in my life." Everybody different, you know.
How did you teach to the, you're trying to teach them the language, which is in a sense a foreign language to them.
Yes.
How did you manage
to
teach?
Well, I tried to write a little book myself that would fit them, and I got, there really weren't too many books that would help, you know, that weren't kind of, too difficult for them. But some of them, I had a good many colored people from the Deep South, too, that hadn't had any. And I had a girl from Mexico, one of our soldier boys, married her and brought her up here and then ran away from her. And she was trying to learn it so she could get a job, you know. And I had some barbers that suddenly out of the blue, after they worked downtown for 20 or 25 years, they made a law that required them to pass an eighth grade examination. So at that time they were junior high, 7, 8, 9, there weren't any eighth grade. So Carl Soller, the principal, and I had to make some tests so that the poor man could go on with another 20 years.
Yeah.
Some of them are a little ridiculous, aren't they?
That's right. Well, you made, in other words, you just simply wrote, what would be a 3 hour class?
Well,
a typical three hour class.
Give them, sometimes I let them choose. Now, I can remember one night one man wanted to learn division of fractions. And I went over it with him on the board. And this Ben Friedman I told you about, he was supposed to be reading. And he came up and he said, "Miss Powers, if you'll go over that once more, I'll do every problem on the page," and he did. They were bright enough. They had that strong desire, you know, and that's what it takes.
Well, they didn't want to be different from the people they were.
They wanted to get a respectable job, don't you know? That was it. Oh, and some of them went. When you heard them tell the stories of what went on in their youth, you just felt ashamed of yourself to think that you'd ever grumble. Terrible. I had one boy by the name of Helmut Fellers. I think he was Russian. I don't know whether he was Russian or German. And he said to me one day, he said, that my father was a Nazi. And my mother was Jewish. And they put her and her family into a concentration camp. And he said, and one girl was a a ballet dancer for the government, and she was all right. She was with Dad, the Nazi, see. So he said they took him to a camp. He was just a little kid, and I think he had TB, he said. But anyhow, one day they were moving him, and he was going through a lineup of people, and his grandmother saw him and ran out to him, and they shot her dead right in front of him. And then a little while afterwards, the same thing happened to his dad. The dad tried to come over and talk to him, and he killed him right in front of the child.
Mm-hmm. Were most of them then, who were in this evening class, people from the continent of Europe?
Yes, there weren't many South Americans, no, or Mexicans, a few, but not many. Pretty nearly all come over here from Hitler and Mussolini. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Bergman said that they would arrange it this way for the Jewish children. She said she lived in a little town and had to go to another town to school, and they went through forests that were filled with wolves. But she said, first they would say only so many Jewish children from this town can come to school, and then they would put the price up so they'd screen them again, see. So she said, I was lucky. A teacher in the town liked me and took me to live with her. That's the way I got through school.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what suffering is, I guess.
Right. Right.
But I felt so bad for them. I didn't ever get gushy. I never spoiled them that way at all. I wanted them to be on their own as much as they could, because they were going to have to live without me after. And they sure do. They go all over that town. A blind girl called me yesterday that I had. She lives in Newcastle. And she went down the street a few weeks ago, and a girl in a car came along, and she was the only one that had a dog, a seeing eye dog. And the girl tore the harness off the dog. He had to have 70 stitches. And there that blind girl stood in the middle of the street. And the dog, she said, picked herself up and walked on three legs and took that girl home before they took it to the hospital. And she said it had to have 70 stitches. Mm-hmm. Now it's back to work again.
Gee, isn't that something? Well, all the time you were teaching the blind and teaching a new language to students at South in the evening, you served as a trustee for the Hubbard Library too, didn't you?
Yes, from the time it started, I was in 33 years, 37 to 70, I guess. Does that make it?
Well,
that was just one meeting a month, you know.
Yeah, but there's, what were some of the pleasant experiences you had as a trustee?
Oh, it was nice. I liked it. We had, we went many times to meet with other people. Here's my neighbor coming in. He's going to pay his rent. You don't mind, do you?
No, go ahead. You're starting to tell us about some of the pleasant experiences at being a trustee at the Hubbard Library.
Oh, well, we visited other libraries sometimes, and conventions, things like that were very pleasant. And then it certainly was a pleasure to see it grow. Mm-hmm.
What did it start out as size-wise?
In the school, in Roosevelt School. Just a few rooms. Mm-hmm. And then as it got bigger, we built the building.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't done much about the children's library, so I was lucky enough to be able to give them a kind of a sizable contribution. So the children's library, the one that I'm most interested in, is the Rose White's Powers Public
yeah.
Library.
Yeah.
So I'm proud of that. I'm sure that the people that that use that part of the library aren't going to learn very much bad.
Well, you hope not anyway.
No. Or very many bad books. I think if they read, they're not going to get into trouble.
You also taught at Youngstown.
Youngstown
College and University, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, Dr. Mayer and I were friends, good friends. We had gone to Pitt year after year, back and forth together, you know. And so he waited for me for several years to, he wanted me to take the psychology of exceptional children. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, wait till I retire, so I did. And then he gave me that, and I taught mental health, psychology of adolescents. And then one day, he didn't like this very well, one day an old friend of mine asked me to take a children's literature course in the School of Education, and I did. He didn't like it very much. He found out about it. He said, did Athens Reese get you into that? Then I taught communications, I think, for a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really.
What year did you teach at Youngstown?
Six after I retired in 63 up till December 67. Mm-hmm. Then they became a state, went on the retirement system, and we old timers were already on, so we had to get out.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't very well pay in and pay out at the same time.
That's right. That's right.
I hope that's the only reason.
Well, you know, that's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about Youngstown College and Youngstown University when you were still part of the public school system?
I didn't hear that.
What do you remember about the school when it was going through its growing pains?
Well, I didn't go until I retired.
Yeah, I realize, but you were in the Youngstown school system.
Yes.
And you saw the school grow from a college to a university.
Oh, yes, and there were quite a good many of my friends that were up there already, you know. One was Miss Athens Reese, was a very fine primary teacher, and such things as that. Well, a good many of them I knew. And I knew Dr. Mayer for many years. Oh, yes. But it wasn't nearly so big as it is now when I left.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering sometimes if some of those buildings aren't going to be empty.
Well, we hope not.
What?
We hope not.
I hope not, too. But I'm afraid that some of them went to get out of going to war, aren't you?
Well, I think so, but you know, now that we no longer have the draft, we've acquired a student who is interested in obtaining an education. I think it's
a little bit of that wanting to put you off track started when I was up there. I remember they kept wanting to start arguments about ESP and about drugs and about all that kind of thing. And I kept quiet for a few days, and I wrote to the American Medical Association, and so the next time that somebody brought it up, I said, now I hope we can settle this all today, I said. I didn't have any facts before, and I wrote to the American Medical Association, and they said that these drugs do break up the chromosomes, and the chances are there could be a retarded child. Now I said, all of you men, young men, will probably be fathers in another 10 years. Now I said, this is all I have to say about it. I don't have anything else. I said, if you should have a retarded child, it might be as innocent as anything in the world. But I said, if you have doubts about it, maybe you'll wind up in a mental institution. I said, now, as far as I'm concerned, that's all I know about it. And I said, if you're willing to take that risk by taking a trip, then I can't stop you. But I said, from here on in, we're going to have 2 oral reports a year, and I want you to read the lesson, and I want you to take part in the class. And I said, if you want a good grade, you'll do just that. And I said, then there won't be any other problems at all. I really never had any disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
But some of my friends down in the grades, one teacher told me not long ago that a 7th grade boy gave her a push, and she took him to the office, and he said, I thought she could take a joke. And she said, yes, nice joke, you knocked me down.
Mm.
But she quit. That's the trouble too, Mr. Earnhardt.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the fine teachers are retiring before their time, don't you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just when you get good.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'd like to ask you one last question.
I'm sorry, I talked you nearly to death.
No, you didn't. Would you have changed your vocation if you had an opportunity to?
I think I was meant to be a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Sit at that desk, really.
Mm-hmm.
I tried for a little while to be to work in the office at the sheet and tube, but I didn't like it so well.
Mm-hmm.
I made out the bonuses in the cost department. It was pretty much like school teaching, but no, I believe I was meant to be an old maid school teacher. Real dyed-in-the-wool spinster.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't try to keep any strict rules or anything with my blind class. They came and went and came and went, just like as if they would at home, you know. Bring their work in. If I thought they were slowing up and getting careless, then I saw to it that they did their homework before they went home that night, so that they had it. And when they took tests, the teachers would send the test out to me. Sometimes I would read it and they'd braille the answers, and then I wrote under them. Every child learned to type. I had to teach them to type too, as soon as he was about the 4th grade.
Mm-hmm.
So that he would be able to help himself. He'd
mm-hmm.
either type them or write them in braille, and I'd write underneath and send them back to the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And they always were willing to accept them. Everybody was nice to me, everybody. I never had no trouble with any kind. I guess I was just foolish enough to be happy. Or maybe stupid enough not to know.
Well, do you have anything else you'd like to add for the historian in the 21st and 22nd century?
I can't think of anything else. I'm lonesome for school, really, that's the truth.
I said I had one last question, I have another one. Do you see many of your students?
Yes, they come to see me. This one in New York comes back to see his parents in Youngstown at Christmas time. They always come out to see me. The one from Patterson Air Base visited me last summer, and the ones around here. One of my girls is a very able girl. She graduated from Western Reserve with honors, but she's very bitter because the only good job she could get was in the South someplace. And she has to support her mother. So she had to accept the concession at the post office. And it didn't go down very well. She feels bad. She feels like as if her life was, she wanted to get out and go places, you know, mm-hmm. too. She does remarkably well. I don't know how she makes that change. She told me at Christmas time that I told you I had taught them to knit. She made 100 sets of little booties and things and sold them at Christmas time while she was sitting there at the stand. Mm-hmm. So, they have ambition, they try. That's the whole thing. I don't think I have any right to claim much credit for that. If they want to do it, they do it. But of course, they need a little guidance.
And some encouragement. Well, thank you very kindly.
They're all my good friends. I can prize myself on that. They call me. One of my girls called me from Newcastle yesterday and talked about a half hour. I was wondering what the bill was going to be. Long distance.
Well, yes, thank you very kindly for sharing an hour or so with us.
Talked you to death.
No, you didn't. No
way
at all.
When I get started on my pet subject, you can't stop me.
Well, that's okay too.